And welcome to Trippy Politics Protests and
Potpourri.
I'm your host, Corey Elia, and as always, my co-host,
Leslie McLam.
Brenda, do you want to start or should I?
I will start. Okay. I am Britta Olson. I started the Bend Equity Project, second iteration of mutual aid. Been doing this since November 2020.
Hi, Eric.
Yes. Hi. So my name is Eric Garrity. Along with Britta, kind of started Bend Equity Project in March of 2022. But with Britta, we've been involved in mutual aid in Central Oregon since November of 2020. And it was Black Friday when we first did our initial outreach. Been involved mostly with mutual aid organizing, a lot of food, but also other services as opportunities arose for the past few years, and tried to perform mutual aid, but also do so strategically so that we're actually trying to make significant, like, systemic improvements in Central Oregon.
So why in 2020, what motivated you then to participate and get involved in the Bend Equity Project?
Yeah, so when we started, it was 2020, the pandemic. We'd all been isolated for quite a while. And at a really basic level, I think there was a lot of folks, especially in Central Oregon, where the cost of living is so extreme, seeing community members that were increasingly putting out asks for assistance, making payments for rent, or having food insecurity. And so at a really basic level, it was, we're stuck at home, no one's traveling to be with their family, and it was a conversation. Some of us were involved with the local Democratic Socialists of America chapter, but we basically just decided that it would be good to get out, see folks directly, try to serve food that was high quality. And Bend's a pretty small community, and so there were relatively limited resources, but I think really we just wanted to kind of be compassionate and direct and serve food that we felt was high quality. And really, that was just the starting point, but we continue to learn and kind of grow and figure out how we could most directly help people.
Yeah, and just to clarify, so the Bend Equity Project actually didn't start in 2020. The Bend Equity Project started in 2022. The first iteration was a coalition of different organizations that did not last, and so we started over again. And basically, it's almost kind of like a phoenix, you know, rising out of the ashes of the previous group. Actually, Corey, you were a big inspiration because I watched your stream all the time in Portland and loved it. You're by far my favorite streamer. So,
oh, thank you.
Yeah. So that was an inspiration for me, is to like get involved and just like do whatever I can, because was so much action happening and I was just watching from the sidelines, and was tired of doing that and wanted to actually like, basically, you know, put up or shut up, you know, get in there and actually help.
It's like what Mahatma Gandhi, be the change you wish to see in the world, right?
Exactly. That's a big part of Bend Equity Project, is just making it visible, because people are so scared of the houseless community that they don't know how to care. They don't know how to... They're scared in themselves of all the propaganda that's put out there, when people are people, and all people deserve food and dignity and love and community. And that is a big part of the Bend Equity Project.
That's beautiful. So
it kind of brings us to where I ended up reaching out to Eric, and then Eric brought Britta to my attention and the whole situation out there in Juniper Ridge in Bend.
So I don't know much about it, but I've gotten a few highlights. So hopefully you can inform me more directly about the Juniper Ridge situation. And I guess there were some concerns about some individuals and reports that were given to the city. What can you tell me more about that?
Eric, you want that one?
Sure, I'll take it. So the current situation is, I guess for context, it's worth noting that one of the largest encampments, it was an unsanctioned encampment around Hunnell and Clausen Road, which are two roads kind of like adjacent to each other nearby. And that was a population at its highest around like 80 to 100 people, which is a pretty large encampment for Bend. And that had recently been swept after the city of Bend decided to implement a camping code that requires folks to relocate at least 600 feet every 24 hours if you're camping in a tent, or every 72 hours if you're living in your vehicle. And those requirements to consistently relocate are what I would call like a continual displacement model. And so, yeah, we've had this huge sweep of people that was kind of slow moving. It was over the course of like June into July. And so that encampment has been swept and everyone has relocated from that area. So at this point, the Juniper Ridge area is one of the few locations around the city where people are more or less allowed to exist without being forced to comply with that relocation requirement. There's a bit of city property, county property, and Bureau of Land Management property. Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit of a murky situation with different stakeholders. At a high level, there's about at least 100, probably a couple hundred folks that are living in this Juniper Ridge area. It's a pretty scattered encampment, so you'll see a few vehicles here, a few vehicles there. It's a pretty difficult area to access. I drive a 2010 Honda Civic, which isn't really like well equipped to get to some of these encampments. And the county just recently passed a similar type of camping code where they would be requiring people to relocate. The one caveat, though, which I will give Deschutes County credit for, is that so far they verbally indicated that there will not be any sweeps until people are provided an alternate location to go to. That's been one of the challenges with Bend, where the local government has decided to sweep people despite the fact that they have really no options for where they can go long term. And it's difficult because the population we're talking about is largely, a majority of people are suffering from some sort of medical or mental disability. And so complying with those requirements is pretty difficult. And we have an Americans with Disabilities Act process where people can request a reasonable accommodation. But it's... the reality is that people are not getting the sort of assistance to make those requests for accommodation. And so it's just a really untenable position. And in practice, whether this is the intent of the policies or not, people are just being forced out of the city.
Right. It seems like a bit of an unreasonable burden for someone with no resources, no job, no money, no societal connections to be required to find a new location to reside in for only 24 hours. That becomes the entirety of their every single day. And therefore, to me, it seems absolutely impossible for them to even comply with going to offices, to fill out paperwork, to partake of services, to get out of that cycle if they have to spend the entire day finding a new location for their tent or vehicle. And what kind of challenges were brought up during that legislative process, because that just seems sort of violatory of individual rights that the citizens have in this country, regardless of their socioeconomic status.
Yeah, that's one of the problems with the way these policies have been designed by the City of Bend attorneys. I suspect that they're very cognizant of the Martin v. Boise and Grants Pass decisions restricting these types of camping requirements. And to be fair, they've written them in a way that would make it difficult to challenge for whether it's like the ACLU or Legal Aid, Oregon Law Center. That being said, the code was passed before the Oregon state law, ORS 195-530, took effect, which has the requirement that any restrictions be objectively reasonable.
Yeah. Now that the state has that passed, though, couldn't that ordinance be challenged with the grounds that the 195 supersedes the local laws, and that it does, that the current policies do not align with a higher jurisdictional order?
Yeah, so at this time, I can tell you that right before the camping code were set to take effect in Bend, so that was, I believe, February 28th, Bend Equity Project, the American Civil Liberties Union of Oregon, and local attorney Thaddeus Betts, who is now working with the Oregon Justice Resource Center. But at that time, we sent out a letter indicating that it may be subject to challenge for running afoul of that state law. But at this time, there's not been any formal complaint filed.
So what would it take? Would it just take a citizen of that city or county that's under that ordinance to petition or challenge that law? Is that what it takes?
With the caveat that I'm not an attorney.
Yeah, of course.
I'm kind of the cook of the group, but yeah, so the current situation, under the statute, there is required to be a tort notice sent to the City of Bend 90 days before any complaint would be filed. So with the Oregon state law taking effect in July, we would need that 90-day window to elapse. So I would not be surprised if there is something further litigation.
So it might come up in the next month or two as that 90 days approaches. Okay.
So
yeah, but
this could be a very this could change. The situation could change as far as that ordinance goes in Bend sometime soon.
And so I hate to, like, pivot away from where we're at, but I do want to go into the whole how I came across this situation. So I follow a lot of different publications out in the rural area and whatnot, and I believe it was Eric that was quoted that caught my attention. There was a report on the situation there in Bend that was produced by an individual I've been following for about a year now who is basically approaching the situation of homelessness from a very anti-harm reductionist, pro-punitive, exploitative,
non-humanitarian approach.
Yes, and he screams about trying to address the humanitarian crisis, but these are all things that seem to be counter to what's going on. And he was hired, correct?
And you know who we're talking about, right? He used to work out, I guess, with the city of Gresham before they parted ways.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes. I haven't been in touch with anyone from Gresham, but my understanding is that the folks that were involved just indicated that they had parted ways and were no longer associated. The story of how—so Kevin Dahlgren is the gentleman we're discussing— and the story of how he came to Bend is kind of interesting. So I first became aware of his work after he had come to Bend and spoken at some neighborhood associations. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of interesting because there was at least one, I believe, two neighborhood associations where he was given like a speaking slot. He was hired to come to Bend in the first place, at least based on posts on Nextdoor. By a local, I would say, maybe not activist, but someone who's involved in the community and started a PAC, a political action committee called Bend Unites. And so Kevin was hired to come to Bend, He was speaking at some of these neighborhood associations. And then from there, I'm not exactly sure on the timeline, but he, well, actually, I do know the timeline. So he was hired by that Bend Unites PAC at least prior to June 1st, which is when this local community organizer stated on Nextdoor that her PAC had hired him to come to Bend. At some point after that, he also was hired by the Deschutes County Sheriff's Office for what I believe is a contract of $18,000 to write a report and also perform like an unofficial survey. And that survey and report, there's some concerns, to put it mildly.
That $18,000 is a lot of money for a report. I'm wondering what kind of technology or services and were used to generate this report that required it to cost so much. How many people were involved that were paid? How many man hours were used? Is there a receipt for this payment?
So I do know some local journalists are curious about this and attempting to gain that sort of information at this time. So while we were actually serving our weekly meal at the Hummel Road encampment, we actually did encounter Kevin as he was performing his survey. I know he had a clipboard and a pen and paper. Yeah, he was working alone. He was also talking with one of the local people that had been staying on that street as well. So kind of like using that as a way to like introduce himself and get that survey. When it comes to the actual survey.
That may be a biased survey then.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Which means you can't really rely on the results. And therefore, is it worth really that money for taxpayers to pay for? As it's not neutral. Curious.
Our local.
Sure, I see Britta smiling over there. I must be saying something that just tickles your fancy.
I just love it.
Yeah. Our Deschutes County Commissioner Phil Chang did question the value to the taxpayers of using $18,000 of taxpayer money for this type of survey. And there's two, setting aside like, there's misspellings in the report. There's some reasons. I would say it's not an impressive piece of work.
It's only a couple hundred dollars to buy a year of Word products, right? The Microsoft suite that comes with Word with spell check. I think that's only a couple hundred bucks. So, yeah. Huh.
I can tell you $18,000 is a lot of money. And, yeah, it's concerning. The two big facts that really stood out to me as really just sloppy work, and admittedly, I question the intent and honesty in this type of work with specifically these two statements. So one statement was that the point in time count indicated that there was over 1,000, I think it was like 1,600 approximately individuals in Central Oregon, or maybe it was Bend. I would need to check the details, but questioning the amount of people that were counted during the point in time count. And to the best of my knowledge, everyone that is interviewed for the point in time count is assigned some sort of unique identifier. And the point in time count would indicate that a service provider spoke to each person on that point in time count. So to do an unofficial survey, like new to the area, whereas established service providers had done the point in time count, came up with a number, to then come in after the fact and say, well, at my high estimate, it's about 700 people. When there is unique identifiers, there's service providers that know the community, there's coordination between those service providers, I question whether that person is acting in good faith.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Yeah, because it seems like they're getting a number to suit a specific goal. Like they did research to support a result that they desire, and that's really not good research.
And I just want to throw in here too, usually the point in time count is an underestimate as well.
I mean, what was the big estimate that we had several years back? I want to say
they actually basically changed the definition of homeless to include everybody that is living on the edge of homelessness. and did a survey of Portland and found that as opposed to the 1-point time count, which back then put it about 4,000-something, that they found that there was actually 32,000 people living homeless or on the edge of homelessness. And, I mean, that's probably applicable to Bend as well.
And I can say that I was never talked to in a point in time count during the times that I had housing instability in Portland. So I know for a fact that those particular types of counts are underestimated. They can't capture everybody. So as a journalist, I agree with you that it absolutely raises questions that someone new to the area comes in, they parachute without any familiarity. They're being guided by a specific source that has a benefit to leading this person around to give them the answers they're seeking, and it's to come up with a result that seems designed to explicitly challenge a more established, more thorough and appropriate research method. So,
I would agree with that, and it wouldn't be, unfortunately, it wouldn't be unprecedented for Bend to do that sort of assessment with an end goal in mind. In this circumstance as well, there's reasons to call into question whether this is a report and a survey that's done with an express purpose in mind. And that's considering the chain of events. So someone coming to town, having speaking slots at neighborhood associations where they are advancing this anti-harm reduction and pro-drug war narrative, that person then to receive a contract for like close to $20,000 within a matter of weeks from the local Deschutes County Sheriff
feels like a link right there between a government entity with the sheriffs that are supposed to be serving all members of the public at all levels, but yet there's that connection there with the neighborhood association. Like, that's clearly, it seems to me, how the sheriffs got in contact in a way with this individual, that the path was through the neighborhood associations, which are often, they're socioeconomic based groups. I mean, only certain people that can afford to own homes, that have certain income levels, particular interests, and they don't experience certain kinds of concerns that the vast majority of members of the public do. So it seems like an obvious correlation to me.
It certainly is concerning, and I say that especially concerning the fact that the person who created the political action committee that brought Kevin in initially was also a significant donor to the campaign of the local county commissioner, Addie Adair, who's a member of the Republican Party. So there is, I would say, documented evidence to at least ask the question whether there was some level of coordination going on.
If they truly wanted to get a perspective that is outside of the point in time count, they want some other party to come in, it seems like they went through personal, private, preferred channels, people that are already aligned with their attitude and ways of thinking, rather than seeking out somebody who has experience and is going to do research from a neutral, non-biased perspective. See what I mean? Like, you see where I'm getting at? It seems like they're creating back channels to find individuals that will do work to deliver them a result that is now on official record, and they can use that created and fabricated record that has the bias built in order to continue advancing these echo chamber attitudes, certain groups of people with certain class privileges.
I think there's a lot of problems with Bend's neighborhood associations and the exclusion of voices, people that are renting. The neighborhood associations do very much silence a lot of historically marginalized communities. That being said, I do think there is certainly a bias that's been kind of demonstrated by some of our local county commissioners, whether it's statements about reopening institutions, whether it's criticizing Measure 110. There's a lot of similar messaging from, like, I would say, the local kind of conservative reactionary politicians. And unfortunately, we're not really being helped by largely Democratic city council and mayor that have been elected in Bend. So there's not a lot of pushback. And it's sort of, I would say, asymmetrical in the way that the Republicans and conservatives have their messaging and seem to be coordinating that type of messaging, whereas...
Do you get much help from the state level at all or any attention, or does it all sort of disappear to bigger cities like Portland and Eugene?
We have, so there, we do have state representatives that are very aware of local issues. Representative Emerson Levy has been advocating for a lot of great things at the state level. Jason Croft, there are state level officials that I think are doing good work. I just think there's a lack of awareness from our local officials as to how to actually address homelessness. And I think determination at the end of the day.
So you brought up something a minute ago that I've been exploring a lot too, and it's the talk against Measure 110, which I seem to remember from the report that, like, even though Kevin found a percentage of drug users within the homeless population that he counted that was similar to the point in time, he basically went forth and suggested something that he believed it was more like 75% of the population was using out of just his observation. And one of the things about the pushback on Measure 110 is that it's actually pulling $25 million from the cannabis taxes that actually would have went statewide to so many different police departments. And so it seems to be that this pushback against Measure 110 isn't just because of the slow rollout and the bureaucracy about trying to get all these nonprofits funded and up and started and going fully, but also to try and strip this money away from this measure and put it back in the hands of the police departments.
There's timings on certain funding, so if they can't get a project started within a certain approved amount of time, the funding that was set aside for it goes back into the coffer. And so it's like slapstick lawsuits. If they can run out the clock, they can get the money back.
So, yeah.
But go ahead,
Yeah, I have the report in front of me pulled up, and the statement is that 7% of the homeless report addiction as the leading cause of their homelessness. I believe it is closer to 75% of all adults currently homeless in Deschutes County. So that statement, taking the number that's self-reported as 7% and then somehow interpreting that to be 75% is just, that would be the other statement that I was alluding to earlier that just defies all reason, and I think it is fair to question someone's whether they're operating in good faith when you can take a self-reported number.
How did he get to the 75? He just says.
I think
he froze.
Oh no.
Yeah, he did.
But I'm just wondering, how does he even just get to that? How do you just whip out a number and you just say 75? Right. Like, oh, so 3 out of the 4 people you specifically talked to, but that's not a good. That's not good research. Like, in order to say a number like that when you have supposedly done research or supposedly been in the field and gotten information.
Yeah, so blatant that he has an agenda with just that one statement. Like, that just discredits everything that he says because he doesn't give any reasons. And that's not a report. That's an opinion.
Yeah, I would agree. That's an opinion. Yeah.
So this is probably going to end on us in about 5 minutes or so. And the last thing I wanted to touch on was the addition of armed patrols that started showing up at Juniper Ridge or whatever. Was it related to the report or was it before the report?
And who pays for the guards?
So it's my understanding that it's a local company, security company, that is being hired by the sheriff's department to patrol. I'm not sure exactly what they're patrolling for because there haven't been patrols out there previously. They're still negotiating the contracts currently with that, but it was also recommended by the actual sheriff's department that they carry guns, which is terrifying to me that a private security company is being told by our law enforcement to carry guns against private citizens. Like, that is so next level wrong.
What scares me about that is that when the sheriffs are done it, they're a sworn officer of the law, and they are required to follow the law and respect people's constitutional rights, or they lose their right to that privileged job position. And when you hire private security, you lose that protection. And what's the legality of a sheriff hiring private security mercenaries to do their job for them? Like, and exactly. That's a big problem right there for me.
Exactly.
So, sorry, Corey.
One point to clarify. So I'm not sure if it's the sheriff's office that is hiring this security contractor. It was the sheriff's office recommendation that the security patrols be armed. There has not yet been a confirmation that I've seen whether that would be like less than lethal type of weapons or if it would be actual firearms.
I'm wondering, what's the justification for that recommendation of carrying a weapon? Are they suggesting that there is an extreme level of violence that consistently occurs that requires that level of armed response?
I've not seen anything released publicly that...
they haven't given a reason.
Well, in that case, I wonder, constitutional rights of the people that are being patrolled, whether by the sheriff or private security, that seems to be a question then.
Yeah,
it is an open question, and it is something that I am very concerned about. And I do think that once those plans are finalized, we will be trying to take a microscope to those and verifying whether or not this all seems as whether this is actually as pretextual as it seems, or if there is any potential violations of people's constitutional rights. I know that is a primary concern for Bend Equity Project moving forward.
So is Bend Equity Project online? How can we suggest people follow this? Because it's going to cut off us here in a minute. So, like, what's the best way that people can follow the situation?
Risa, you take that.
We have a website, bendequityproject.com, we are on Instagram. We have a Facebook, and that's pretty much it currently.
I'm going to personally try and keep an eye on this as well. And I'll keep in touch with Eric and like try and update what I can when we kind of figure out what's going on more. But yeah, I mean, I really thank you guys. Cause like I heard about this and I just kind of put my little journalistic antennae up and I was like, I need to investigate. So.
And when he told me about everything going on, I was just kind of shocked and said, we have got to talk to you both and see what is happening out in Bend. So thank you very much for all your time today.
Well, thanks for
Thank you so much.
Oh, yeah, that's
great. Thank you very much.
KBOO Portland.